unemployment rate of more than 53% and poverty reaching about 70%, Palestinians hope to obtain the permits to find work opportunities in the occupied lands and the West Bank that will help them to reduce their poverty. Since Israel withdrew from the Gaza Strip in 2005, it no longer allowed Gaza workers to obtain permits that would enable them to work, as tens of thousands of workers used to go out daily to work in the occupied lands as their only source of income in the fields of construction, agriculture, industry, and tourism.
The Israeli blockade on the Gaza Strip has led to an unprecedented level of unemployment in the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, about 70% of Palestinian families suffer from lack of food, and this is all due to the collapse of Gaza's economy.
The Chamber of Commerce says Israel should be held accountable for the growing rate of unemployment in Gaza. The daily hardships endured by Palestinians, along with the crippling blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, led thousands to search for work opportunities outside Gaza. Palestinians called on the international community to end the siege and develop solutions to reduce high rates of poverty and unemployment. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
A two-day meeting of the G20 leaders of the world's 20 major economies wrapped up in the Italian capital on Sunday. A final communique issued at the end of the summit contains a weak compromise commitment on climate change and COVID-19 vaccine sharing, which has drawn wide criticism from some politicians, activists, and public. Leaders have agreed that nations must take meaningful action to keep the world from warming by no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels without setting any specific criteria to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Furthermore, although the communique does include plans to end overseas investment in coal this year, no specific actions to limit domestic coal use has been set out.
The latest United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report shows that we must carry out immediate, rapid, and sizable cuts to emissions to avoid disastrous consequences. So some of us are asking why we move our goalpost from 2 degrees to 1.5 degree. Why? Because science says so.
The G20 leaders have also agreed to establish a 15% global minimum corporate tax for the biggest multinationals in a bid to end the damaging race to the bottom on corporate taxation. However, no developing or poor nations will benefit from this ruling, as multinationals have their bases in wealthy countries and large companies will continue to generate revenue in poorer parts of the world. A long-debated web tax on digital giants such as Apple, Google and Facebook has been scrapped.
Lately, the G20 summit seems to have lost its relevance, with leaders of several countries, including China, Russia, Japan and Mexico, not attending the meeting. During anti-G20 rallies, protesters have slammed the summit and the statements that follow, saying that such initiatives are disconnected from reality and people's needs.
The G20 summit talks weekend was accompanied by large protests. Three anti-G20 demonstrations attended by young students, left-leaning groups, climate change activists and trade unions were held in Rome between Friday and Saturday.
The G20 is made up of politicians who want the finance to take over politics, politicians who want our country in the hands of Brussels, Frankfurt and the Silicon Valley.
Many fear that the G20 leaders' mild pledges on climate neutrality and coal financing could result in lost momentum ahead of an upcoming crucial COP26 climate summit in Glasgow. Max Civili, Rome.
Her name means hope in Arabic. 3 years ago, a photograph of Amal Hussein showing her skin and bones sparked shock and anger across the globe. A week later, she starved to death and became a striking symbol of the catastrophic situation in the war-torn country.
The number of malnourished cases is increasing daily compared to previous years during the brutal aggression against our country. We expect that the number of malnourished children exceeds 1 million across the country. Amal Hussein was only an example of the suffering of millions of Yemeni children. What is the fault of Amal and these children who suffer from the consequences of the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia? It is the children who pay the price, unfortunately, under the coverage of the United Nations.
Amal was one of nearly 2 million children suffering from severe malnutrition in Yemen. With 3 years having passed since her death, the situation has not got any better due to the continuing food crisis in the country and the lack of medicines for children.
We receive patients from all governorates, including very bad cases that suffer from extreme poverty and are unable to provide the most basic needs of children, whether medicine or food. The organizations say they provide everything, but what they receive is very little compared to what they need. And it is difficult to get medicines for malnutrition. Some parents get forced to leave the center before the treatment ends, and as a result, a large number of children die, as what happened to the child Amal Hussein back in 2018.
The years-long Saudi war and siege on Yemen have killed tens of thousands of civilians, including women and the children, and pushed the country to the brink of famine. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, where more than 20 million people rely on aid.
Amal has died, but the hope is still alive for millions of Yemeni children who continue to suffer from the consequences of the ongoing brutal Saudi war. However, the international community, including the United Nations, has not taken any action to put an end to the humanitarian crisis in the war-ravaged country. Abdulatif Roshali, Sana.
Russian officials reported 40,993 new infections on Sunday, exceeding the previous record of 40,251 reported earlier. They also added that 1,160 people died of the virus on Saturday, three fewer than the record set on Friday. Russia's COVID-19 death count has raised to 237,380, by far the largest in Europe. Meanwhile, over 8.47 million infections have been recorded in the country of 146 million.
Most enterprises and non-essential services in Russia are closed till November the 7th, but the possibility to extend the quarantine is very likely, as it has already happened before.
In Moscow, severe restrictions have begun earlier. Almost the entire service sector is on lockdown. Schools and universities' classes have been closed as well. To cope with infection, President Putin ordered a non-working period from October 30th to November the 7th, when most state agencies and private businesses are to suspend operations.
I just don't understand what's going on. We have a reliable, effective vaccine, and there are only two ways to get through this period: get sick or get vaccinated.
Despite the ever-increasing growth of infections and endless semi-restrictions, some Russians are in no hurry to get vaccinated. Others consider them to be mandatory.
My opinion is very simple. Vaccination is a responsibility act. It should not be a matter of option. It should be mandatory. It's the only way people will be able to beat COVID. As simple as that.
This was not a mandatory part of the program, and people were not forced to do it. Everything could be much better. But when we understand that conditions are being set for us, if you want to work, go get vaccinated. If you want to go to the theater, get vaccinated. If you want to eat in a restaurant, here is a QR code. Get vaccinated. This is already a cattle whip method.
About 51 million Russians, just over a third of the country's people, were fully vaccinated as of Saturday.
They may say anything they want. There are many cases of how severely vaccinated people get sick and die. Why is nobody talking about this?
Observers say one of numerous factors of cited distrust in the authorities' care can be explained by the adopted budget of the new State Duma, where in the next 2 years a reduction in health care costs by 300 billion rubles provided. It seems that plans to treat Russians with vaccines against the background of medicine optimization no longer leave illusions for people. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kiddie. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
The Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profits on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israel is perpetuating its land grab policy in the occupied Palestinian territories under the nose of the international community. According to a UN report, demolition and confiscation of homes in the West Bank and Al-Quds have increased by 21% compared to the previous year. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has also reported a 28% rise in the number of Palestinians displaced in the same period. Some 310 structures have been seized only in Area C on short notice or without advance warning. Area C accounts for more than 60% of the occupied West Bank. Well, it doesn't stop here. Israel has also unveiled plans to build some 3,000 more settler units in the West Bank. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let me introduce our guests in this edition. We'll have member of the European Parliament from Ireland South, Mick Wallace, who's joining us out of Brussels. Also, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, is joining us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome our guests, but let's first go to our correspondent in occupied Ramallah, Mona Candil, is there. Let's ask Mona for an update on the latest Israeli settlement expansion policy. Mona, go ahead.
Well, it seems that Israel is still insisting that it deals as a state above the law. It ignores all the international demands that settlement is illegal across the occupied West Bank and in Al-Quds. There were demands by the international community for Israel to stop immediately all kind of settlement activity. However, the Israelis know that they got the support from former U.S. President Donald Trump. They got a green light to continue settlement activity, and here we are seeing first the Israeli regime approved 3,000 settler units across the occupied West Bank. Several days later, it approved over 1,700 settler units across the occupied West Bank, in addition to approving the construction of two new settlements inside the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. It was the first approval for settlements in 20 years in that area, and they know that they will not receive nothing but condemnations and demands to stop the settlement activity. They know that they won't receive any sanctions. That's why they are ready to approve more settlement units, and they would be annexing more Palestinian lands to the illegal settlements and seizing more Palestinian lands illegally.
Okay, thanks for that, Mona Kandil, correspondent in Ramallah. Now, let me put the first question to Mick Wallace in Brussels. Mick, as you see statistics clearly indicating that the Tel Aviv regime is pushing ahead with its illegal settlement building on Palestinian land, grabbing more and more land, rendering more Palestinians homeless. So let's start by talking about the main factors leading to this rising settlement expansion.
Yeah, look, there's probably nothing unusual about it in the sense that it's kind of what we expect. The Americans, as your previous speaker said, give a blank check to the Israelis to do whatever they like. And there's a number of reasons for that, obviously, which we probably have our time to go into. But clearly, everyone knows that it suits the Americans to have a satellite state like Israel in the region, and it's no surprise, given that America has been pretty lawless for many, many years themselves and have had little or no respect for international law, there's nothing unusual about the fact that they allow Israel to totally disrespect international law as well, of which the settlements are part of. But I think what's really crucial as well, though, is the fact that the EU are complicit. And it was probably never as obvious as in the recent war where Israel was bombarding Palestine and the EU were refusing to condemn it. I mean, you had a situation where the president of the European Commission, von der Leyen, came out and condemned Hamas rockets for killing two children in Israel, but refused to condemn Israelis killing 66 children in Palestine. Now, I mean, it is so blatantly bad that it's embarrassing for European citizens at this stage. But I would insist that the EU complicity gives Israel a lot more authority and power to behave as badly as they do around the settlements because of the EU support.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, let me ask Mr. Bangash about Washington's unflinching support for the Tel Aviv region, how much it has been responsible in actually for incentivizing the Tel Aviv regime to turn a deaf ear to global condemnation and continue building more and more settlements.
Well, as long as the United States government, regardless of what persuasion, political persuasion it may be, whether Democratic or Republican, continue to finance this illegitimate Zionist entity, this settler colonial entity in Palestine, obviously there is no incentive for the Israelis to stop their aggressive settlement policy. They go further, of course. They go and barge into Palestinian homes. They attack Palestinian families. There are at least 5,000 Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli prisons, including hundreds of women and children that are even threatened with sexual violence. They continue. This is all very well documented. Amnesty International has said it. Human Rights Watch has said it. Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem, they published reports regarding all of these things. Right. And yet Israel continues because of the U.S. underwriting of its illegal criminal activities of settlement expansion. We need to keep in mind that today only 8% of the Palestinian territory is left for the Palestinian people. You know, the West Bank is under military occupation. The Gaza Strip is a vast open-air prison, and even the Palestinians living inside what is referred to as the Green Line, which is the 1948 border, their rights are being disturbed. There are dozens of laws that constrain the rights of the Palestinian people there. Mm-hmm. And of course, then we see Israeli encroachment in Jerusalem, on Masjid al-Aqsa, etc. So when you put all of these things together, it is evident that America is basically underwriting Israeli crimes, and America is complicit in it. In fact, I would say virtually the entire Western world, with the exception of, for instance, Ireland,
yeah, virtually all the countries are actually... We'll come to that at a later point, yeah. You're right. Okay, now, Mick, there was another measure that Washington took in the name of helping the Palestinian, helping resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, Mick, and that was putting forward the so-called deal of the century. And you know how Palestinians regarded what kind of a deal that was. It was total bias toward Israel, and it simply further deprived the Palestinians of their rights. Let's have your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, if it wasn't so sad, you would have said it was a joke. The deal of the century was, I mean, how anyone could even speak about it with a straight face was actually surprising. First of all, it was given Israel total security. It was allowing Israel control over international borders of Palestine. It was doing away with, once and for all, the right of return, which is absolutely vital to the Palestinians. And obviously, it was harping back to the two-state solution, which, from my perspective, is dead. The two-state solution has been killed off, and it's obviously been killed off on purpose. And sadly, the Americans and the EU still plays lip service to it as if this is a way forward, when we know it isn't. Also, of course, another part of the deal of the century was that the Palestinians would be responsible for the suppression of Palestinian movements that might be in opposition to Israel. Well, I mean, that's actually in place already, because sadly, the Palestinian Authority, as far as I'm concerned, are part of the problem and are not part of the solution. And they work as like a security force for the Israelis and the Americans, and are funded by them. So that's already in place. But no, the deal of the century was an absolute shambles, and it makes a mockery of any notion of a settlement going forward. Absolute nonsense.
Yep. Mr. Bangash, 104 years ago today, we had this declaration of Balfour that was issued by the British government, and you mentioned the Western world in this, and it facilitated the immigration of European Jews to Palestine, and many believe it was a major catalyst of the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1948. Do you share the same view?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Balfour had no right, the British government had no right to promise the land of the Palestinian people to the Jewish people. Of course, it was Europe for much of its history that has persecuted the Jewish people. And whenever they were persecuted, the Jewish people would seek refuge among the Muslims. And we as Muslims are proud of the fact that we have never persecuted the Jewish people, and we shouldn't. But regrettably, what Balfour did as Foreign Secretary of Britain at the time is to promise in a letter, it's a short letter, promised to the Jewish leaders that the British government would facilitate the establishment of a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. Of course, it did also had a rider that, you know, nothing should be done to affect the religious and social rights of the Palestinian people, but there was no such mention of their own state. Now, the Palestinian people were not even consulted. And the reason for the Balfour Declaration was that the First World War was going on, and Britain was keen to get America involved in the war, and until that time, America had not intervened. And the British basically promised to Lord Rothschild, who was a very well-known banker in the United States. He had connections all over with the American elite. And in return for this promise, Rothschild was supposed to get American help in joining the war to defeat Germany. And that is exactly what took place. So it was a conspiracy at several levels. The worst of it was that the Palestinians' homeland, without their consultation, they were an overwhelming majority in 1917. In fact, the census done in 1912 showed that there were only 6% people of the Jewish faith, and the other 94% were basically Palestinians, the overwhelming majority Muslims, and a few Christians. And yet, they were not even consulted about what their who their land was going to be given to. So that great disaster is the one that ultimately led to the Nakba and the destruction of about 530 villages and towns in Palestine, thousands of Palestinians killed, and about 750,000 Palestinians ethnically cleansed in 1948.
Right. Nicholas, Britain was not alone. It enjoyed the backing of the U.S. and France in the Balfour Declaration that resulted in the expulsion of, as Mr. Bangar said, some 750,000 Palestinians from their homeland. Now, more than 100 years pass, 104 years exactly. Have things changed in terms of Western support for Israel and its occupation of Palestine and land grab and all that?
No, listen, the story 104 years ago and the story today is pretty similar. They might do things with a prettier face these days, and they put a better face on things sometimes. Mm-hmm. But empire does as it sees fit, and they show no mercy, or they show no respect for the rights of what would be regarded as the smaller nations anywhere. But it should be noted that at the time, in that letter that Balfour wrote to Rothschild, he actually, in the short letter, he actually said, "It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine." Now, obviously, they knew bloody well that there would be trouble coming from this. And there's a very interesting quote. I mean, obviously, the fact that I'm Irish, it was something that I found very interesting. But the first British governor of Jerusalem, a fellow called Ronald Storrs, he described this arrangement, the Balfour arrangement, as and the idea of expanding the Zionist projects, allowing the Israelis to go in there and gradually take over the place. He described it as a little loyal Jewish Ulster in a sea of potentially hostile Arabism. Now, I mean, for an Irish person, that carries a lot of significance. And it was interesting. You know, there was a general UN General Assembly resolution in 1975. I think it was number 3379. It was by a fellow called Fayez Syed. And he says that it was when this happened back in 1917, he says the reciprocal interests had thus come to bind British imperialism and Zionist colonialism. Because you should remember that the Brits had other ideas at place as well, and the Suez Canal was a big factor. And the idea that they would have a foothold just in case relations with the native population, in case it turns sour at any stage, they felt that having a foothold there by planting the Jews there, they felt that it would probably strengthen their capacity to hold on to the Suez Canal influence, because that was vital for the Brits at the time, especially with all their trade with India. But controlling the Suez Canal was paramount for them. And this was also seen as a way of strengthening their hold on the Suez Canal.
Right. Now, Mr. Bangash, you talked about complicity on the part of the U.S. and maybe some European countries. It's not that only. We have also a number of Arab states that have signed these so-called normalization deals with the Tel Aviv regime. Instead of standing by Palestinians. So how has that emboldened the Tel Aviv regime to go on usurping more Palestinian land?
Well, that's exactly what it is. These Arab regimes, without even consulting the Palestinian people, went ahead with their so-called normalization process. Mm-hmm. We need to keep in mind two points. Number one, that the Palestinians were never consulted, and the Palestinians actually condemned this normalization process. So that's the first thing. Secondly, when we look at these Arab regimes, these were again creation of British colonial intrigue. Back in 1916 and so on, Britain and France went about their intriguing ways to divide the Middle East into various statelets and so on. Out of that emerged Saudi Arabia, and later on countries like Kuwait, United Arab Emirates, and so on. These countries actually never existed before. These were basically tribes, little tribes, essentially with a tent and a camel outside. And of course, oil, once it was discovered, became a big issue. And the British and the French went about creating these regimes, which had no legitimacy whatsoever, but they served British imperial interests. We need to keep in mind that it was Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel, who said that the Arab regimes are the first line of defense of Israel. And I think he had said that back in 1948. Right. And today, we see that these Arab regimes are, in fact, they have become complicit with Zionist crimes, Zionist settlement policy, Zionist expansionism, because these regimes were created for that purpose. And they have stabbed the Palestinian people in the back. So much so that they have even abandoned Masjid al-Aqsa, which is the third holiest place, the first Qibla of the Muslims.
Right.
I mean, if these Arab regimes had any self-respect or dignity, they would not do such a thing, but obviously we know that they don't have any self-respect, they don't have any dignity. They are simply agents of imperialism and colonialism, and now they have become agents of Zionism as well.
Okay. Now, Mick Wallace, you know that agreements haven't helped the Palestinians. They've not been able to restore their rights. International organizations haven't been able to do much. Mediation hasn't worked. Palestinians have just lost more lives, more land, and they've been deprived of their rights over the years. So what's the way forward for them now?
Well, I suppose, obviously, being a member of the European Parliament, I'm very conscious of the fact that the European Parliament talks about human rights and the rights of all the different groups across the world to live, the right to live a good life in good conditions. But yet, what we see is we see the EU and the Americans has been very selective as to whose human rights they care about. Mm-hmm. Right now, we become obsessed with the human rights of the people in Belarus. Now, it's obviously not a coincidence that it's on the Russian border, and NATO wants to further undermine the security of Russia by encroaching more on Belarus. But the very fact that they had been oblivious to the terrible suffering inflicted on the Palestinian people by the apartheid state of Israel for so long now, it really exposes the hypocrisy of the European Union. And I mean, if you ask me, I mean, what's the way forward? I mean, for me, we can forget about a two-state solution. The way forward now is where it's all one country and is run in a democratic fashion. There's human rights for everybody, whether they're Israelis or Palestinians or anybody else. It would have to include the right of return for all Palestinians. But it would be a place where everyone would live a decent life.
Right.
And obviously, right now, Israel, that wouldn't suit them, because Zionism, I mean, it is, you know, it's not just a colonial project, it's a racist project.
Right.
And given their racist nature, they don't want to go to that space, but it's up to the likes of the European Union to push them there.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Let me thank our guests. We had member of the European Parliament from Ireland South, Mick Wallace, in Brussels, and director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, in Toronto. I've been your host, Behrouz Mahdafian. I'll see you next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In many ways, the immigration crisis is the latest chapter in a rolling history of the U.S. interventionism. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jonathan N.G. Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Haiti's Humanitarian Crisis Reveals Human Costs of U.S. Interventionism. Stay tuned for more. This September, U.S. Border Patrol agents violently seized Haitian refugees along the Rio Grande, attracting fierce criticism and international attention. Officers on horseback trotted through families, wielded their reins as whips, and chased migrants carrying their meager possessions in plastic bags. After scandalizing public opinion, President Joe Biden deemed the operation outrageous and promised that the border agents will pay. Yet, behind the scenes, his administration has swiftly deported thousands of Haitians. Authorities frequently exploit Title 42 of the Public Health Services Law to expel refugees seeking asylum. "We're doing this out of a public health need," claims U.S. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, adding it is not an immigration policy. But in practice, the legal subterfuge has allowed Customs and Border Protection, CBP, to turn historic numbers of migrants away. Recently, the U.S. Special Envoy to Haiti, Daniel Foote, resigned in protest, denouncing the inhumane, counterproductive policy. Since then, humanitarian crisis has only deepened. Blocked from reaching the U.S., Haitians now constitute the second largest group seeking protection in Mexico. For most, the border is simply the latest stretch in a grueling continental odyssey. Many traveled across Latin America on swollen ankles, braved discrimination, and survived unspeakable adversity. And now they wait. Observers routinely cite Haiti's recent earthquake, grinding poverty, and political upheaval for the immigration crisis, but neglect an essential factor. While U.S. officials jealously guard the Texas border, they have not hesitated to violate Haiti's. In many ways, the immigration crisis is the latest chapter in a rolling history of U.S. interventionism. For over a century, the United States has decisively shaped Asian affairs. Fearing political instability, Woodrow Wilson sent Marines in 1914 to relocate the Haitian National Bank's holdings to New York. A year later, they invaded Haiti to protect the investments of Western creditors, initiating a two-decade occupation that entailed the ruthless suppression of dissent and wholesale transfer of assets to U.S. corporations. Ultimately, the U.S. left a legacy of militarism, saddling the island with a bloated army that repeatedly intervened in politics. Asian legislators approved the law reorganizing the military under U.S. pressure. The constabulary shall be organized and officiated by Americans, the act crisply stated. Racism inflamed fears of political instability, ostensibly justifying U.S. intervention, and indelibly shaped the occupation. Commander Smedley Butler waxed paternal, later claiming that occupiers were trustees of a huge estate that belonged to miners. As Butler filled the army with Haitian recruits, he called his subordinates little chocolate soldiers, and elsewhere described himself as the chief of police force. The U.S. Marines withdrew in 1934, but the Haitian military continued exerting preponderant influence over island politics. In 1957, the army swept François Dolivre into office through rigged elections. Until 1986, the Dolivre family retained power by creating a personal paramilitary force and turning the army into a privileged caste. As a former political prisoner Robert Duval observed, traditionally the army of Haiti was always the one that gave and took political power. U.S. military intervention returned after Jean Bertrand Aristide became president in 1991. The Salesian priest secured national stature during the dwindling days of the Dolivre dictatorship for his advocacy for the poor. Yet his liberation theology, reformist agenda, and critical independence alarmed the U.S., which backed his removal in September 1991. After Aristide returned to power in 1994, the Clinton administration slipped army and paramilitary records out of the country in order to shield officers from prosecution. The next year, Haiti dissolved its military, yet in early 2004, former officers poised to again oust Aristide. Their leaders included Guy Philippe, who received training from U.S. Special Forces, and Louis Jodl Chamblain, a retired officer who previously led a CIA-backed death squad. Their main goal was to re-establish the military. The Bush administration finished the coup with crude finesse. In February 24, a delegation of U.S. diplomats and troops arrived at Aristide's house. They warned him that rebels were coming and would slaughter his family unless he immediately boarded a U.S. chartered plane. Remarkably, the U.S. delegation refused to protect Aristide despite its air of authority and abundant arms. They had not only the force of the embassy but the Marines with them, Congresswoman Maxine Waters explained, adding they made clear that he had to go now or he would be killed. Indeed, the U.S. embassy obstructed his own security detail. After hastily ushering Aristide to the airport, the delegation refused to let him board without tendering a letter of resignation. The U.S. Navy SEAL escort then held him incommunicado for nearly 24 hours, denying him access to a telephone and spreading him out of the country. Aristide called the drama a modern-day kidnapping.
His overthrow signaled another turn in the spiral of militarism. While the U.S. military mission consummated the coup, the Bush administration promoted the occupation of the island. 2 months later, it spearheaded the U.S. stabilization mission in Haiti, a formidable force of 9,000 blue helmets. The first independent country in Latin America became the only country in the hemisphere under foreign occupation. While militarizing Haiti's political crisis, the United States of America supported the ruling class that previously identified with the Bolivar dictatorship and bitterly resented Aristide, and both mobilized to prevent his return. According to a secret cable, Chief Edmund Mullett of MINUSTAH urged U.S. legal action against Aristide to prevent the former president from gaining more traction with the Haitian population and returning. Former U.S. Ambassador James Foley agreed in a telegram with the terse titled, "Aristide Movement Must Be Stopped." As leftists rode the pink tide into office across Latin America, the Bush and Obama administrations deemed the Red Priest a threat to the island's pliant ruling class and neoliberalism. Privately, a special U.S. team prepared a dossier on Aristide, scouring his past for criminal activities to sully his reputation. And this summer, the two histories of interventionism intertwined. On July 7th, a band of mercenaries assassinated President Moi of Haiti. Most were veterans of Plan Colombia, and at least seven had received training from the United States of America. Their contractor, CTU Security, is a U.S. firm owned by Antonio Intrigo, a friend of Colombian President and Uribe protege, Ivan Duque. One leader, Captain German River Garcia, recalled their chilling orders. Everyone had to be killed. The police, the prison security, everything we encountered in the house. Another participant explained that there could be no witness. Following the assassination, Haitian Prime Minister Claude Joseph requested the U.S. and the U.N. send troops, eliciting widespread opposition. An organization representing retired military officials encouraged Haitians to reject the humiliation of foreign intervention. Yet, on August 14th, another earthquake gripped Haiti. In response, the U.S. sent Marines. They brought the USS Arlington, MH-60 Seahawk helicopters, P-8A Poseidon planes, and other military equipment, prompting observers to doubt their humanitarian mission. The cycle of crisis in Haiti and Colombia reveals that interventionism is not simply an event by a system. Incredibly, the United States Southern Command both trains Colombian troops and oversees humanitarian aid in Haiti. As the situation deteriorates, Haitians have sought refuge in the U.S. No destination on earth is more attractive for a Haitian. The Island Daily Law Nova Steel reports, adding, yet the refugees along the Texas border all think that the USA is largely responsible for their hardship and the sad state of their country. The latest chapter in the history of U.S. interventionism is neither tragedy nor farce, but defies literary convention. And yet the immigration crisis is cruelly poetic. Haitians are fleeing the violence of interventionism by running to its source.
Good morning. heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.